Welcome. I was told go, so here I go. You made a very, very good decision on this Saturday evening to come to this event. Our big thank you, Our big thank you goes out to the Arts Council, as always, for their continuing support of the festival. They are, as you can see, they are really eager to come on stage, so join me in giving a warm welcome to Malaika's Photo Kitchen.
Thank you, Katerina, and thank you all for coming. Here we have six members of Malaika's Poetry Kitchen. Serafima, Rishi, Malaika, Peter and Jacob. So, oh, and me! I'm Jill Abram, I'm the current director of Malaika's Kitchen. I run it like an autocracy.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, you're not even joking.
So, you know, what I say goes, and if they don't like it, they can do it themselves, frankly. So what is Malaika's Kitchen? It's a collective that was set up 16 years ago. We had a Sweet 16 recently by Malaika and Roger Robinson, who, here's an opportunity for a plug, you can come and see it in this very theatre tomorrow afternoon with my next event. That's Stablemates at 2:30, and he'll be joined by Nick McCoa and Seni Senavaratne. More of that later. So Malaika and Roger and Jacob set up Malaika's Kitchen to encourage craft, community and development. And what it's morphed into now is six Fridays a term we meet for about 2 hours to do a workshop. And most of the workshops are led by members, but I'm very well connected, you know, so I invite people to I invite people to come and lead a session for us, people I think will be interesting and give us a different perspective, and they come for not very much money and an awful lot of love, so that's fantastic. And most of our sessions are generative, but we have feedback sessions as well, because I think peer group feedback is a really important part of development. So I think we should get straight into some poetry. These guys don't know this. I've got a little surprise for them. I have chosen a little bit of music to introduce each of them.
Oh, no.
Now, some of them, you'll get why I chose them, and some of you might not. So there's a couple of little in-jokes. I will explain them to you after the poet has read. So... So Greg is our tech for tonight. Thank you, Greg. He and I have been colluding. We've worked this all out.
Thanks, Greg.
So our first poet tonight is Serafima Kennedy. I'm going to talk a little bit about what each of the poets have done kind of outside poetry or outside their own writing. And one of the things, Serafima grew up in the vicinity of Grenfell Tower, and you might have seen her on Channel 4 News, or you might have seen her articles in The Guardian. And she has kind of been spreading the word about some of the background to the situation there, so that's been absolutely fantastic. She has a... She's been studying postgraduate work at Goldsmiths University, and she's recently started working at Norway, and today... People come from all over today. Today she has come down from Newcastle, where she was at a big conference up there. She was running a big conference up there. And so I think I've said enough. Please welcome Serafima. Greg, play the music.
Oh, thank you so much, Jill. That's the best introduction I've ever had, I think. Who is it by?
Oh, I'll tell you later.
Oh, okay. It had the word Serafim in the title. Okay, so that's brilliant. Well, thank you so much to Jill and to Malaika's Kitchen, actually, and to the festival for having me. I've sort of known these guys for a long time, but only been a member of Malaika's Kitchen for about a year. And I was thinking about this today, actually. I think I first met Jill and Malaika at the same time at a workshop that Malaika was leading. And I was ill in the second part, and the next time I saw Malaika, I was too embarrassed to say hello, so I had to reintroduce myself about 3 years later. Anyway, I'm going to write, because of we've known each other for a while. I'm going to read a sort of old favourite of mine, which I wrote in a workshop with Pascal Petit that Malaika was on. I'm just going to set my timer, because that's how organised I am. Okay. The Tornado Chaser. After Tornado by Francis Alice. The Tornado Chaser is superstitious. He wears a tornado like a cloak of lightning. His dreams are dark tunnels with stars slipping down them. He can find a tornado blindfolded. He smells the fresh-torn redbud tree, the earth's spores offered up to the elements. He catches the vacuum with his bare hands, wrenches sap from flying timber. The Tornado Chaser sleeps with sand in his eyelashes. His foxbrush hair has been drowned in Florida saltwater. He's been baked in mud in the Mississippi. He's tripped through scrub claw in the Texan panhandle and been thrown to the sides of the orange dust caldera. He has seen a tornado unwrap the night sky like a handkerchief. He's been in red and turquoise and gold tornadoes. He's been in tornadoes made of ocean. He knows tornadoes that spin him in different directions above and below his fault lines. He knows the heart of the sky is the dark back of the mirror and the space between constellations. He's known tornadoes shimmer like sirens. He's known tornadoes slice him open like crazed turbines. He knows one day a tornado will strip the flesh from his bones. He will feel his skin split, his eyes spread out wider than the great American plains. He's looked up the length of the tornado in fear. He's looked up the inside of the tornado in longing. He's seen the dark vaulted cathedral above the tornado and prayed. So as Jill mentioned, I grew up in Kensington, Chelsea, and worked there for a time afterwards. It's made the news recently for all the wrong reasons. So I'm going to read you a couple of poems which I've just written in the past few weeks. This first one is called The Budget. How quickly understanding is doomed to fail at the sudden turn between question and statement, investigation and proclamation, science and propaganda. Tonight we must use all our tools. Deep breaths, diazepam, watch the world from far away, clutch at loved ones and pay attention to a pink sky stretching back towards the horizon. Pay attention. We thirst for the real, but would like to be kept from its cruelty, its smoke. You may thirst for different things, water, papers, hair straighteners. Once I cycled through these streets, past cityscapes of square-clad buildings. Tell me now your rules for burying the dead. Home. I have wanted to leave. I have gone into towers, rising up to meet flocks of seagulls perched on red cranes. I have met mothers like mine, working in the dark, against hunger, against the voraciousness of the electric key meter. I have wanted a home. I have reverberated with longing, like a bounce check dying to be true. You, who have never been desperate, tell me, how do you begin a ruined life? Okay, sorry, I went a bit dark there. Okay, so I'm going to read you now a long poem, which is a sequence. This is its first public performance. Wait. I also require audience participation. Mm-hmm. Are you ready? Are you ready? Okay, good. Okay, so I'm going to read you, this poem is called The Passion. It's 14 motets for the Mediterranean. A few years ago, I was talking to the poet Karen McCarthy Wolfe, and actually she wasn't talking to me, Karen. She wasn't talking to me. She was in a panel at the Poetry Book Society Fair. Some people here might have been there as well. And there was a protest outside, and it was to do with the NHS and nurses' pay. And I think when Karen was on the panel, she was like, oh, I arrived and I saw the police outside, and I thought they were here for the poets. and she said, I mean, why aren't they here for the poets? You know. So we had a conversation about poetry and being political in writing after the panel. And it was interesting, it was only a few years ago, but you know, already it does feel as though the landscape has shifted slightly, and it's impossible for many of us writing now to write in any other way. But anyway, I'll stop. This poem is called 14 Motets for the Mediterranean, and it reflects some of my preoccupations. There are a few things you need to know. Lungomare is an Italian word that means beachfront. Saragina is a character who's in it, and she is a character in Fellini's movie 8 and a Half, which some of you might have seen. And there's a line from Bach, which is from his piece, The St. Matthew Passion, which I've stolen, haha, which I can do because Bach is dead. So he can't sue me. Anyway, which is what you should do, steal from dead writers. Okay, so a motet is a short piece of choral music. Jacob. And it's often polyphonic. Jacob wasn't here for a rehearsal, so I have to tell him. And I'm going to ask you, when I get to motet number 13, to repeat a line for me. Now, the line is, have lightning and thunder forgotten their fury? Have lightning and thunder forgotten their fury? Okay, excellent. Very good. There's so many poets in the audience. Brilliant. Okay, we're going to start quiet. We're going to work up to being quite loud. And it doesn't matter if you're in time at all. In fact, the sort of less in time you are, the better. Okay? And I'm going to ask you all to stand up, please. And you have to listen to me because I have the microphone. Okay. All right. When I get to motet number 13, have lightning and thunder forgotten their fury? 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 Excellent. Thank you very much. Okay, round of applause for you all. Brilliant, 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 brilliant. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so you can sit down again. Oh, no, I'm sorry. You can sit down again. Okay, so and if I forget to tell you to sit down, then just stay standing up. All right. The Passion. 1. April, as you know, a cruel month, veers from rough slate to crash in milk-white frills over black rock. Out there, the depths are endless. Here, there are days when sunshine heats the flat expanse to a calm white horizon, and an old man cycles gently along the Lungomare past a row of empty blue chairs. 2. Ask me, and I'll tell you, how these memories flicker in the cavern of your skull, a projector on an overturned hull, a sheet spread out so flat you could bounce right off it. I saw the soprano's belly tightened and flip, a fetus kicking for breath, pressing against her ribs. 3. Saragina, la rumba. Saragina lives in a cave beneath the sea. Her hair is a serpent's nest. Her eyes are flicked with coal. Her dress is ragged over powerful thighs. She'll dance for a lira, calves kicking through the slit of her skirt, then fold the black-caped boy into her arms. But look, here comes the priest to chase the boy into the sea. Saragina, la rumba. 4. O month of sweet lilacs, calm winds, flat seas, of new boats arriving, the quick, slow, old metal, rubber dinghies full of holes, engines filling with water, hulls of vomit, feces, cries, ay, 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 dissolving as the coastline wears away, an ocean vanishing under the weight of bodies. 5. In the brack, a fan of empty quills, the hollow bones, a skeleton picked clean, its sharp bill grinning like a sword. 6. It was a complex culture, privileging ideas of innocence and suffering. Each year, they worshipped a lamb, or what they called a lamb, sacrificing it with garlands of flowers and sweet desserts made from the cocoa bean. 7. Not rock or calcium into water, but the idea of water into a grave, body upon body. 8. It was important to be afraid. They told each other stories of brutal murders, constructed vast plays that were broadcast globally. It was remarkable technology for their time. 9. Mediter. Midway this life, yes, this medicinal life, Yes, yes, in this medulla oblongata, in its mediocrity stunning, yes, grinding its molars, tonguing its outer membranes, sweat meddling its brow, metatarsal, a crushed and broken bone, mestizo, off finally. Here. 10. They love the brutality of it, stripping, skinning, stabbing, every surface of the skin pricked and bloodied with thorns. They had these lyric symbols, the robin, the lamb, who they worshipped and devoured. A strange people, sadistic even. We're more enlightened now, of course. 11. Aye. 12. Chorale for a rabble. Though we are changeable as a shoal of glinting fish, we will sing you to sleep. It is the people sending you to your death, to be bundled into immigration vans and deported back to battlefields and sniper towers and police cells, your city falling the way cities always fall. 13. Have lightning and thunder forgotten their fury? 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 Fellini, Fellini, I have had enough of you. Thomas Stearns, your son of man has not delivered. What can you teach me about the ideal women? You, with your broken images. What can you teach me of a man? You with your mistresses, you with your life like a bad Russian novel. I have had it with your despair. Nihil desperatio, desperatio. Estio otis, the man besotted. En vive, vivant, vivi, viv, vivienne. Okay, how was that? Well, thank you very much. Thank you so much for participating. It's a bit of an odd one, so yeah, I've been writing these long sequences and I'm not entirely sure how I feel about them, so thank you very much for getting involved. Alright, I've got a couple more minutes. I'm going to read a couple of things just to, one more poem, just so you, and a slightly more hopeful note. Things a sonnet might be made of. Pitch, bulrushes, water, feathers, tar, spun silver, a length of pine or birch, a boat, a bicycle, a pair of shorts, maquette of the Sun King and his court, a dictionary, a thread, a rope, an ark of the new covenant, a jar of honey, a waterproof coat, a wad of money, a mobile phone, a pair of walking boots, a cap, a compass, a needle, a map, a string of prayer beads, hope. Thank you.
Thank you, Serafima. If any of you have ever done an ARVON course, which is a residential writing week, you will have received an invitation to apply for the Jerwood ARVON mentoring scheme, which is a year scheme, and you get a very top quality poet tutor to mentor you for the year, as well as the as well as peer mentoring from the other mentees in three different genres. And we were really excited this year when Serafima was chosen as one of the latest batch of mentees. So the next poet is Peter Reynard, and when Peter was a new poet, he went to Malaika's classes at City Lit College in London. And then one day I was sitting outside the South Bank with the poet Jo Bell, who many of you may know. She was a former trustee of this festival. And it was the year she was doing this Project 52, which was an online project. And I was always used to people coming up to her and going, complete strangers going, are you Jo Bell? I go, oh, 52, 52. And this man came up and said, are you Jo Bell? And I went, oh, 52. And he went, no, it was Peter. And he was setting up a website called proletarianpoetry.com. And it features the poetry of working class lives. And he'd come over to ask Jo people that he could invite to send poems. And each poem that he posts, he does a blog post about as well. So it's a really fascinating site. I recommend that you go and look at it. And he then asked Jo if she would mentor him. And because he was in London, she'd often stay with me when she came down to mentor him. She'd go, he's awfully good, you know. So I invited him, naturally I invited him to join Kitchen, and he has been so enthusiastic about Kitchen. It's been really fantastic. He's led sessions and he's just kind of pushed everybody along, and it's been great to have him as a member. And we had our last session just 2 weeks ago, and Peter said, I think we should do an anthology. I said, brilliant, Peter, if you want to take that on, yes, we'll do an anthology. 2 weeks ago, he's already had a conversation with a publisher who might be interested in publishing that. So Peter Raynard gets things done. Let's have his music.
A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be.
Yeah. Okay, no comment. Hello, Ledbury.
Hi.
Hiya. Hi. I'm not very well, so I'd like to apologise in advance for my Coventry accent. I am Peter, and I have the name of my father. Before you were thought of, conceived, or born, as the first boy, your name was given to you by your father's faith. Handed down like a broken watch or faded picture of long forgotten ancestors hidden in a bottom drawer. Carrying this weight of two names to be passed on, you went out to find a wife and bear a son, since that was the way to honour men. Look, there's old Peter with his son Pete and Thomas with Tommy. Today they've got their own little millennial boys, Isaac, Felix, Xavier and Jacob, rewriting their granddad's line in the sand as the old men spin above their graves asking, who will spell the world now? I'm glad to say my father joined the atheist wing of the Catholic Church when I was six, which was actually very lucky because the priest turned out to be a paedophile and abused many of the people that I became friends with later on. We don't coordinate between us because I didn't realise, I'm not surprised that Sarah had written a poem about Grenfell. I wrote this poem about, well actually the first draft of it was in Malaika's workshop in the module I did with her, and I've since changed it many times, and this is for Sarah. A revolution in housing. Arise, you high-rise, arise. End slumming it and rent to kill. Take flight, you council cathedrals. Attack the sham mammon of steel. Ring out your bells with the cry, we have no fear of defeat. Take every slice of the sky. Make treason of the streets. Occupy, occupy royal parks. Richmond, Greenwich have belief. Seat your castles atop Crystal Palace, Highgate and Hampstead Heath. Take another view, cause trouble. Remember the Putney debates. Don't give in to the lies of rubble. Give new meaning to the estates. Across the romance of capital, London has muckles of space. Dream away construction so brutal as you sleep by ponds and lakes. No more the square miles of money will feast on the delights of us. Their wealth kills all that is worthy, lest we forget all those we have lost. Thank you. Being a middle-aged man, I'm very interested in the ways and means of my demographic. How on the surface there seems to be great certainty to these men who stand at bars on their own and drink. And I've never been able to do that. And they have this kind of certainty of, I know what I like and I like what I know. But I think underneath that, there is a great insecurity behind them that is an old-fashioned sense of masculinity that they feel threatened by the world now and therefore revert to deep conservatism. So this is Chatting Up the Barmaid. I spotted a collection of spoons in Oxfam's window this morning. £9.99 they were. That's a good starter kit for those wanting to make a better life for themselves. Nothing wrong with showing off a set of spoons that have never been inside someone's mouth, rested on a warm tongue, loaded with chocolate mousse. I can imagine a set of my own or some such silver shining next to Uncle Arthur above the fireplace in my flat. Cheaper than the tattoos he collected at sea and a lot less painful as well. It must be great when you've like-minded collectors to share with, who don't give a stuff about the "what do you do that for" kind of misers. I used to collect tadpoles as a kid, kept them in a bucket until my mum lifted up the lid to find a jack-in-the-box of frogs jumping up her best Friday night skirt. I now collect Nazi memorabilia. Life must be proper lonely for those with nothing to show. When I was 16, my friend and I thought it was a good idea to put sellotape on our stomachs in the name of Sham 69. And we went out and sunbathed 2 or 3 days in a row. Pulled off the tape, and there we had our own. We didn't need to wear T-shirts. We were Sham fans. And 3 weeks later, my friend was gutted that his had gone. But mine was still there. Mine was still there 6 months later. And the reason that it was there was because my skin was browning all over. And I was found out that I had Addison's disease. And I was down to 5 stone, 2 weeks away from death. And the good thing about it was, I'm here. But the second was, I got to go to this junior endocrinologist's seminar. And they were talking, and I was their case study. And I had to lift my shirt up to all these future endocrinologists who laughed. And the laugh was on me because I hated Sham 69 6 months later. I've since then collected a number of conditions thanks to autoimmunity. There are charities for all of my unequal parts. And this goes with a beautiful epigraph by Lucia Perillo, who sadly died of MS recently. Hope is ravenous like the gulls, and we are being eaten alive. Part one, from the nose down. Low vitamin D requires 20 mcg per diem. To dissuade skeletal crumbling, please handle sunny side up. Low testosterone is corrected with a rear view injection of Nebido, sending the already overachieving libido off the scale. This causes out of your box protrusions to rational thought. A collusive beard mentors hairy areas in how to tuft again on once barren land. Stubborn lungs lay down tools, refusing to take part in the must-try-harder art of breathing. Relief is green and brown, but sometimes blue. A redundant thyroid requires chemical thyroxin, AM, PM, till the end. The cancellation of flight or fight means I am more dry dock than speedboat with the cortisol. The pituitary is an unreliable narrator. The body's regulator that hands in its notice, causing a hot flush of mental pauses that soak the body like tears of an actor in between jobs. The dark overlord of it all, friendly fire autoimmunity, is the wandering serial killer of a stuck-in-the-headlight system of glands, hiding in the bushes of biological ignorance. Part two. Thus from the nose up. I fill out the CBT questionnaire in A minor. I look up words I don't want to know the meaning of. When the letters begin spinning like a neurotic Nickelodeon, I start whistling anti-clockwise. Weights and measures of the mind convert into acronyms, making my life more difficult to spell. My ears swim with violins. The sound of piano keys aches my bones. I live to a soundtrack of not keeping up. I'm expected to come away from a meeting not needing to go back and amplify. Was I okay? At what, I don't know. Were you puzzled by my words or just the fact that I returned? I drift in and out like an armless stagehand. Can I not just tell you I have an aversion to the orders of your syntax, with little interest in staying asleep or being depressed all the time, only to let my family down from a height I haven't the legs to jump from? Part 3. Ecology. This body is a computerised diktat of eternal wormholing by diapetistic endos, furrowed psychos and surface-cleaning GPs who gaze into me through the parallax lines of a close try. This body is a stock exchange that burns from the acid of hope's empty stomach. I've recently stopped taking the antidepressant sertraline. Now, sertraline, besides helping you with anxiety and depression, which it didn't, is meant to calm your OCD. Well, I don't have OCD. At least I didn't until I came off sertraline. Sertraline earworms. And at the end of this, I've got a question that you all have to answer in the mode of Sarah. But don't panic and don't leave, please. Today, I'm being asked if I know the Muffin Man. The Muffin Man. The Muffin Man, you know. The one who lives down Drury Lane. I keep telling myself I do. I do. I do know the Muffin Man. And if I find him, I will eat him. But the question is a repeat prescription, sending me loop-de-loop as I fill my bag with the half-price blueberry kind. My earworm comes in many genres. Punk, reggae, dubstep, grime, I don't mind. But it's pop's incessant water torture of withdrawal. From Ed Sheeran's Thinking Out Loud come guitar loop taps causing brain zaps that pinball off the walls of my disorder. When the SSRI slugs away, it leaves a slime of chimes. Enough to set off lightning bug stage dives into a mosh pit of pharmacology. Minding my own, a drive-by sample of Britney Spears hits me, baby. Much, much more than one more time. Passing Top Shop, take that, they want me. They want me back, they want me back, they really want me back for good. I want to stick tweezers in my ears and pick out the notes hanging like funereal earrings. My wife sings, oh baby, baby, how was I supposed to know that something wasn't right here? I can see that she wasn't supposed to know as I try to keep this swirling wildfire DJ under control. But then I have a moment of OCD weakness. I ask her if she knows the Muffin Man. The Muffin Man? The Muffin Man? To which she asks, the one who lives down Drury Lane? And now, oh baby, baby, it won't stop, it won't stop. Even when she's not there. So what I would like you to do is answer this question of, do you know the Muffin Man? Because I know you do. So I'll sing the first bit, and then all together I'd like you to say, yes, we know him. Do you know the Muffin Man, the Muffin Man, the Muffin Man? Do you know the Muffin Man who lives on Drury Lane?
Yes, we know the Muffin Man, the Muffin Man, the Muffin Man.
Yes, we know the Muffin Man
who lives on Drury Lane.
Thank you. I only did that to give you an earworm yourself to take home with you. This is my final poem, so thank you all for listening, and thanks for Malaika's Kitchen and the wonderful Jill Abraham. Are there any poetry reviewers in the audience? Do you admit to owning up little bits? Well, I think poetry reviewers are the real heroes of poetry, and I've never had the courage to do such a thing, But I'd like here and now to give you my application form, if you like, to be a poetry reviewer. Is it writing or is it typing? Published by Fuck Knows Who Press, this poet's collection is described as an epic tome of 16 3/4 short poems about the trials and defibrillations of his allotment. On reading, however, it hardly stretches to the static life of a neglected window box. We are told proudly there are 247 end rhymes and 311 internal rhymes, which surpass the joint record held by Wendy Cope and Pam Ayres. It fails to mention, however, that these numbers fall well short of any found in one of those rapping person's bars. Instances of assonance pass as nonsense with all the sass of an unwiped ass. There is an elusive alliance of alliteration where the reader's alleviation is merely allegorical. The metres of metre bounce along the track like a stressed, unstressed Usain Bolt in a straitjacket. I was particularly unsympathetic to the epidemic of abstract nouns that made me feel disappointed, angry, and had me reaching for an out-of-date bottle of milk of amnesia. The similes fail in their claim to be paradoxical metaphors symbolic of a dystopic utopian garden. They are more like a rocking high horse of like-minded people dancing in a blender. The preponderant sonnets are meant to be Neo-Petrarchan, but are in fact Fodon Patterson. I hear Patterson intends to sue. The poet's misguided penchant for the surreal appears in poems that are orange, with concrete feathers that fly over a horse, painting a watch found in the cavity of his sprinkler system's sexuality. The form is errant and unreflective of any of the poem's intent to show the wildness of his allotment / window box when a westerly wind blows ashes from the peasant's cemetery across the road. The free verse poems should be locked up. If stanzas are rooms, then our poet is a slum landlord. Quotidian themes of love, loss, death and grief are all covered in a single haiku. Here it is in all its glory. I live with what death leaves. Love, loss, a compost of pesticidal grief. Like much poetry, the book is bereft of rage. Where is the anger at the 2% increase in allotment fees? Or the hatred towards fellow allotmenters, their merciless mockery of his courgettes that look like a jolly green John Thomas in need of Viagra? The blurb on the back cover from the poet's estranged mother says that to truly appreciate her son's work, the reader should tear out all of the pages and post each one of them through the neighbours' doors, just to confirm their loathing of poetry. The poems are nowhere near finished and should certainly be abandoned. All in all, it is a terrible collection, and I loved it to death. Thank you.
Fantastic, thank you, Peter. I was very surprised when Peter invited me to submit a poem to Proletarian Poetry. I said, you do know I'm middle class, Peter? And he said, every poet has a working class poem inside them. And it turns out I did. I'll read it for you later. So our third poet and the last poet for this half, yes, the bar's not far away, is Jacob Samler Rose. One of the fantastic things about Kitchen is the community that it engenders and kind of gets paid forward, and we kind of reach out to other people. And nobody more so than Jacob. Not only was he there right at the start of Malaika's Kitchen, and then when Malaika burnt out and couldn't deal with it anymore, he took over. He was my predecessor. He was the first director who wasn't Malaika. But he's a major part of his life is supporting and encouraging young poets. One of the main parts of that is Barbican Young Poets, some of them then graduated on to become Burn After Reading. You know, they were so influenced by him and what he'd done that they stayed together and carried on for a while. He's recently set up Barbican Junior Poets, which is for even younger poets than that. He was behind the Teenage Poetry Slam, Shake the Dust, all sorts of amazing things. Now, Jacob's music is going to be a little bit more obscure, why I've chosen this one. But if you don't work it, well, if he doesn't work it out, I'll explain it to him later and you can listen. Jacob Samler Rose.
We were speaking of values and violence, breaking silence.
I see what you did there. Okay. Tell them. So, thank you, Neil Astley. My first full collection was titled Breaking Silence. And I thank Neil Astley as my editor, Blood Axe, there. It's a joy to have you in the room, Neil. I didn't get the memo, unfortunately, so there will be no audience participation through this set. Yeah, right? You are safe. This is a safe space. I'm just going to read some poems, if that's okay. This first poem... look out the audience. Maybe not the right audience for this poem. Let's see. So when I was in my youth, oh, so many years ago, I was very fond of arcade cabinets, kind of arcade cabinets that you'd see in late night cafes in various different places in different parts of the city, particularly Street Fighter. Street Fighter Alpha 2, are you kidding? Those kinds of things. This first poem is entitled Coin Op. And it begins with a little quote from Uncyclopedia. And if you are versed in the lore of computer gaming and of arcade cabinets, which some of you may be or may not be, then you may well kind of understand this. AAA is, was, and always will be, without question, the greatest video game player on earth. Okay, see, that identifies a few people in the room. There we go, okay. Coin up. Those were the days in which our list of cornerstone truths began with music and ended with the fact that there would always be a chip shop open in a lonely street, its lights and signage testament against the closing hour and the falling dark. And in that chip shop, Coin-Op Cabinet, a waypoint for the lost, aimless, and hungry. Squat in corner, Buddha of appetite and emptiness. Bless the lottery of dumb and broken stick. Bless careworn buttons bashed to senselessness. Bless shotgun hot seat, winner plays first round. Bless leaderboard, the high score sheet. Whoever cared enough to mark the time with their initials, bless the hallowed AAA. Those screens we poured ourselves into. Bless those nights, our small change lives. It was noted that I wasn't here for the rehearsal. I had just come in from Manchester, engaged in a workshop that was all about data poetry, which I'm still geeking off. And the notion of Manchester being a smart city, producing information and data. And there's an artist by the name of Naho Matsuda, who essentially created an application that was capable or is capable of translating that data into poems. So now you have these installed signs around Manchester that are essentially transmitting the voice of the city real time in poetry. I don't know about you guys, but there's all parts of my brain just firing off the back of that. So I started with a poem about video gaming, and I'm going to continue with a poem that's entitled Assembly Language, which is very much about the relationship between the real world and the world that's constructed by numbers and by data and by digital applications. Assembly language. It's in three parts. So I'll do the one, two, three. One. Every time I fly, I trust the competence of wings, that someone knows the magic art of aeronautics inside out, that the numbers representing lift and thrust add up the way they should, and that the sky won't decide that today it's had enough of playing along. The world is balanced on just such trust. I don't need to know how any vehicle works, although at times it helps. Enough to know ignition ties to motion, that an engine must be watered and fed in order to do what's demanded of it. So much to speak of awe, when you know exactly how the strings are pulled, and I know there's a source code driving everything, sun up, sundown, the worlds within the world. Those kinds of numbers dizzy me. The Escheresque. Alive. Two. For an afternoon, in a gallery cafe, I sit with a man who calls numbers divine, and when he talks, it's like he's touched. Safe in the palm of some larger hand, he's a believer. You can see it in the solid light that's bleeding from his skin. I've known people who believe in music like this, solid notions bigger than themselves, that the world could be reduced to numbers, and that it might be beautiful. After all, he says, what is a body or any permutation of the flesh if not a set of followed instructions? Three. A student on the East Coast confesses he's an addict, that he needs his reality to resemble the worlds he sees on screen. He does this passionately, of course. His tutor asks a gathered audience if video games are better than real life before explaining how he grew up in Belfast, a time when people kept blowing things up and resolved to learn assembly language. Surely one of the tongues of God, purest expression, too much to comprehend. How the simple one plus one could build a world. But perhaps that was where everything began. In the beginning, there was zero. And it was good. Oh, thank you. I often say I don't live. I always say this. It's a kind of a bit of a cliched saying of mine. I don't live for the kind of moments of applause that sometimes happen at the ends of poems. I live for those moments of involuntary response, the oohs and ahs and those moments of consideration. So if you have any more of those, they're currency by all means. I'm working on a series of poems that is kind of working under the code name thus far of Brief Conversations with Difficult Men. And this first poem that I'm going to read from that body of work was actually drawn from Breaking Silence, the collection. And it's entitled Adam, the original one. He says, they separated when she took to burning underwear. She reminded him too much of his first wife, that wildness in her too, the way she wouldn't take anything lying down. Here, his tongue flags, I have trouble with some of the words. I think he says that of everything, the silence worries him most. The omnipresent silence. How of the good old days, she was the only thing left. Here, my notes are unclear. Does he wish they were together? Would he eat everything she'd put on the table, even if he couldn't stomach the taste? That missing rib still itches. The pain, a welcome ache. Oh, I get to share a stage with Malaika. I forgot the joy of this, right? I'm just going to read some poems. Right, okay. Couple of works in progress, couple of other new bits and pieces. There was a stage that I shared with Serafima not so long ago. We shared a rap party experience with each other, and there was a poem that I wrote specifically for that event, which is kind of still in flux and still kind of growing and moving, and it's called Magnetic. It was a rap party, so it was about kind of, you know, around the theme of hip-hop, and in terms of the kind of cultural iconography of hip-hop, vinyl gets a lot of kind of currency and play, but the humble cassette tape, I don't think, was given its due. So, Magnetic. Before you learn to embrace vinyl, cassettes are currency, traded hand to hand. Picture a Walkman's lid, the begging of it, open. When a tape breaks, stretched and careworn, you will learn how to repair. Same precision you might use to thread a sewing machine's needle, you will learn how to run the spool. To lay the music's inner workings out and flat like surgery, like exposed gut and cut, the wounded endings clean and straight for seamless union, sealed with sticky tape. And there it is. In all its simple glory, the mechanics of this movement, its constituent parts, teeth, tape heads, turning, promised revolutions, all resilient, magnetic. Even when deconstructed, side A inseparable from side B. Eternal loop and back to back and infinite, this music and each phrase, each rhyme like scripture, mouthed like psalms with just such weight. Passed down from pause recorded radio and dubbed LPs, rewound, rehearsed and lifted up and spat and boomed from speakers, airborne tapestry of beats and bold new tongues and all this written to the tape. And cued, and ready for the next time you press play. This next poem, so it's a strange and difficult time, you know, like every other day you turn on the news and something is assaulting you. There are a series of poems that I've been kind of avoiding writing because they're just too weighty or too heavy or too much has already been said, and I've been kind of trying to find my way into a few different things. This one kind of just came, and again, this is another piece that's in flux, that's very new. Thank you for allowing me the space for this one. This is a bit dark, so if you are of a sensitive disposition, now might be the time to go to your happy place. This poem's called Witness. A bullet cannot be hungry. A bullet cannot have appetite. Imagine each bullet with an open-mouthed grin like the painted nose of a World War II bomber, which in turn echoes a shark's toothed maw. Imagine the finger. The finger cannot be hungry, cannot have an appetite. The finger is unthinking, is nerve, is reflex, like a blue bottle trapped behind a window and thirsting for the sky. Deep inclination towards light, like a fish hook in the gut. The finger is fact. The trigger is fact. Each bullet is fact, is incontrovertible. The breath will not leave the body without a fight. What I remember is the moment. What I remember is the moment he drew breath as if reborn. Wait, rewind. A man stands in front of a firing squad. I don't know what he's done. The lens of the moment trained on his soon-to-be-broken body. What I remember is the way the body answered each bullet. The way each bullet entered the flesh and the blood left, evicted, like mice under a kitchen's sudden light. The blood left, took to the air like a fine dust, the very dust of him. Ignore the face. How a body collapses under a bullet's scrutiny, intrusion. Focus on the breath. After a long, hard silence, the scene falling still, the room quiet for what we've witnessed, however far removed, this happened. What I remember is the moment. How the body drew a long, hard breath as if remembering itself. Wait. Rewind. Pull it back. Imagine the breath anchored in the blood as if it has nowhere else to go. Imagine the flesh puckering and spitting the bullets back. No. These are the facts. The man, the bullets, each pointed finger. After the bullets, he took a long, impossible breath. The room fell quiet. We witnessed something. I'm just going to leave a moment for that to... So the I'm just going to read a couple more poems, and this next poem is have to get one in for Mum, right? Right. Okay. So this is a poem. I had the joy of working on a commission for a fantastic poet by the name of Dorothy Lehane. And she was working on kind of a project that brought poets and scientists together. And I had the theme of senescence and aging to play with. So this poem's a short one titled The Insults of Daily Living. I've already written too much of the tremor in my aunt's hands and not enough of how I remember them. Only so long before a body unbuttons itself, sloughs off its former graces. In a dream of the future, there's a pill for longer life, a pill to keep the lights on in the city of my brain. In that future, maybe we'll learn to live like bowhead whales or Methuselah trees. In this now, my mother can't stand the fruit flies that come to worship the dappling bananas tirelessly, as if they know something we don't. Maybe two more poems? One? Yeah, all right, cool. One more poem. This last poem, I've been doing a lot of traveling today. This is literally fresh off the press. Very new, and it is just in homage to the journey. It's called In Other Words. There's a reference to vegetarian sausages in this poem. The reference, when you hear the reference, you may take it to kind of, you know, as the understanding of I have something against vegetarian. I really don't. I appreciate vegetarian sausages. I don't actually eat meat sausages, so just bear that in mind. In other words, there's a man with flowers in a bag, which is to say the flowers are false, or rather they are the idea of flowers, or more specifically, a two-headed rose. The flowers look tired, which is to say they've suffered their role for perhaps long enough, as silently as the idea of flowers might suffer if you discount the red of their voice, singular, and seem now deserving of sleep, which is to say retirement, or to be put out to pasture, which must surely be the equivalent of heaven for a flower. Or at least as good as any, a kind of coming home, a way of one idea feeding the next. The sausage on this morning's breakfast plate is vegetarian, which is to say the idea of a sausage. My train leaves in 18 minutes, which is to say I'm traveling, as we all are, one way or another. In a waiting room at Manchester, there waits an empty chair, which is to say an invitation for a body to be relieved of its own weight. On the train, I will surrender my body to sleep, which is to say leave it behind. Wave a white flag at senselessness, and rise. I will not dream, but I will wake with the scent of a poem in my mouth. And for as long as I hold that scent between my teeth, it will exist and keep on becoming something else. Thank you.
I'm really privileged and feel really honored to introduce the next person. Because if it wasn't for her, I'm not even going to try. The thing is, when you're dealing with a Capricorn and you're a Libra and you don't really get dates right, I really shouldn't try. But she's been running Kitchen Now as the director for a number of years. How much?
Seven.
Right. So the other day I said to her, gosh, Kitchen's been going for 12 years, and she said 16. So Jill Abrams is an engineer, a sound engineer at the BBC Radio, and we always benefit from her amazing skills. I met her as a beginning writer. She came to one of my workshops, and then we shared classes at the poetry school and invited her to Poetry Kitchen, and she's taken over ever since. She runs Kitchen wonderfully. It wouldn't be going without her. She invites people to Kitchen. She keeps it running. She really kind of, it's just really as great keeping the community going, and also in terms of having us here. She's a stickler for time. She's a stickler for things being right, and she's a stickler for getting to Kitchen sessions on time, but also really fantastic at finding us some amazing guests to come in and teach us. So we benefit from everything, and I am under duress that I have to at least teach a kitchen at least once a term, or else my name will come off and it will just be called Poetry Kitchen. Could we put your hands together for Jill? And as she makes her way to the stage, could we have Jill's music, please? I like doing that. Could we have some?
Everybody loves Jill.
That one. I'm going to give it you all for your ringtones. I've been here all week, and it's a lovely festival. I really love coming here, but it's a particular treat to be able to read some poems to you at last. And my set is going to comprise poems that have been born or some other way influenced by Malaika's Poetry Kitchen sessions. And I'm going to start with one from the maestro herself. Malaika said, write about somebody who's really special to you. Just start writing some notes. And I was writing about my best friend. She's a fantastic person. And what I was boring myself with the notes that I was writing. And never mind anyone else. And Malaika said, after a while, she said, stop, to all of us, stop, sit back, put your pen down, close your eyes, and picture the person you're working, you're writing about. And I pictured my best friend since we were 11, in a big armchair with a mug of tea. The poem is called Chardo, which is commonly known in English as tea ceremony, but translates more literally as way of tea or teaism. Part one. Her day starts with a mug of tea, which he places beside the bed. He always gets up first to make it for her. It seems to me that in the hours until they slide back under the covers, they are always drinking tea or making tea or thinking about the next pot and who will make it and who will drink it. When I stay, he brings me a mugful in the morning. It is precious that maybe he loves me enough to bring to me what he takes to her. But I don't like tea. So I sneak it into the bathroom and down the drain. Two. I spent half my teens at her house, arriving in that warm kitchen where her brother nagged her to brew up for your guest. So we drank orange juice and went to her room, had heart-to-hearts about bratty little brothers, mean parents and boys. Out of earshot of her large family with its formula of how many spoonfuls of this or artificial that in each cup, which meant a mantra chanted to warn visitors, if you don't like sugar, don't stir it. I don't like tea, but but I always take a cup. It is more than sugar that sweetens this brew. I wouldn't let her boyfriend see that poem for ages. He knows now, but I've told him he still has to bring me tea in the morning. And the next poem was from a session led by Rishi. If I remember rightly, we had to write words on a piece of paper and swap them around, and I got silk post office. Sunshower. The tensor barrier-skinned snake tacks across the floor. We shuffle through its alimentary canal, propelled by LED display and disembodied voice. Red T-shirt, green hoodie, turquoise sari, denim jacket, pass through to service and exit. Last summer, we saw a magician pull a string of silks from his pocket, flinging them up to arc, then pile on the floor. A deconstructed rainbow. It's my turn at window number one. I present my parcel addressed to you at a distant post restaurant. The digits display a high number, but I don't count the cost of sending pieces of our life to bring us together. Preserve from strawberries grown in our garden, a bag of your favourite barley sugars. My yellow scarf infuses everything with l'ODC. There's the blue sweater you asked for. Now I have nothing which still has your scent. I even washed it before I wrapped it up. When you open this packet of us, will it give you home comforts or entice you to return here for more? I hand over money with hope and head out to the high street. Fine rain falls from a single cloud. The sun shines. Where you are, they call it a monkey's wedding. Roger Robinson, who, as I mentioned, was one of the co-founders of Kitchen, told us to think of something that we're a world expert in and perhaps has its own language and write about it. And I had never mixed my work life with my poetry life, but I thought the time has come. I have to write about making sound effects for radio, comedy and drama. There's so few of us who do that, it's easy to be a world expert. And you know what they say about radio compared to TV or film? The scenery is better. When you hear whistling wind, tin-tack rain, boots trudging through mud, weary voices pitching to be heard above the elements, you see bedraggled ramblers in high-vis Gore-Tex, lost on an expanse of moorland, purpled with heather, in mist which could be cloud, despairing of ever finding shelter, food and warmth. I see them too, even though I saw postprandial actors burping and joking between takes in an air-conditioned studio, soggy towels beneath their feet while digital weather washed through speakers to make them raise their voices. I didn't really use much specialist language in that one, so I've written another one, and the specialist language is really in the title. The BBC is full of abbreviations and anachronistic terms, and one of them is grams, which comes from gramophone. So my job title is a studio manager, or SM, and the grams SM is the person who deals with any pre-recorded audio, whether it's music or sound effects or interviews or whatever. And because I work in comedy, we do a lot of shows in the radio theatre, and the corner where I don't always take on that role, but when I'm the Grams SM, the corner where I sit we call Grams Corner. In Grams Corner, I am God. These black boxes in this windowless room frighten some people, but I know what the knobs and buttons can do, what the icons and words on the screens represent. I spend hours at a time with them. I can't see the world outside. In here, I create new worlds, worlds that start in the mind of a writer, pass through mine, then are ready to enter the listener. You're listening in your kitchen as you mash potatoes for his dinner, though he'll barely grunt at you when he comes home from work to eat it. So sail across the ocean with me, in this basin of water, flapping cotton hankies. We'll dive, blowing with straws to find Atlantis. Let's tie balloons to Victorian London and lift horse-drawn traffic into the air. Build a steam-powered rocket to launch into space. Meet aliens with harmonised voices. I'll slow down bull roars and flapping umbrellas to make dragons, then slay them with a laser zap. I can make hell with fire and screaming, or heaven resound with choirs of angels. I'll slide a roller skate to open a portal to the world you want to live in. Tell me about it. I'll create it for you. Oh, I like what Jacob said about the noise. That's lovely. I think this session was led by Yomi Shade, who I think is in Finland at the moment or on his way back from an African writers' festival that's been happening over there. And he said, write down the five senses in any order. Now reverse them and write a 10-line poem. I think we were also told to make it about an event, a significant event, and include one of those senses in each line. So this is no longer exactly true to the brief, but when I wrote it, I knew that there would be two more parts to come, and so it was his exercise that led to the first part of this poem, which is called Avolut. And in Judaism, Avolut is the year of mourning after burial of a parent. And there's another Yiddish word in there, which is Yahrzeit, the anniversary according to the Hebrew calendar. One, next day. Scents of damp earth and wool hang in the air, mingle with salt, an arm around my shoulders, murmurs in a language I don't understand. Off the path, heels sink, ropes lower the coffin. People I have celebrated with all my life take turns with the spade until it is covered. We all wash our hands. Two, unveiling. Today is for memories, not mourning. Recalling the good times, which left so long before he did, elicits some tears. The cloth is pulled off dark grey granite. Gilt letters dazzle in sunshine. Loved and missed. Three, Yahrzeit. Another September Sunday, a sunny one, and the family is together again, celebrating. 19 candles on a cake for his granddaughter to blow out, one left burning. As has been mentioned earlier, I invite guests to come and lead sessions. We've had some very high-flying ones. We've had Kai Miller, Mona Arshi, who both have won forward prizes. And we had Kim Moore, who came down, and I cheated because I thought she was leading us to write about a brief encounter, and this poem started to come. She was actually leading us to write about a confined encounter, but I wrote brief encounter anyway. I looked back, so did he, smiled again. He had reached the crossing, it beeped. He turned away to follow the green man. I turned too, hearing, watch where you're going. Walked on, up the hill, a mile to my one-room flat. By the time I arrived, we were married, living in a country house, taking holidays to our villa in Andalusia, trying to decide on the best schools for our children. That's never going to happen. And I also mentioned that feedback is one of the very important sessions that we have. And this is a poem that I took to our most recent feedback session. So the poem didn't start at kitchen, it just started. And then I went swimming and it got finished. The ideas went, you know, my mind was empty except which stroke to do next, and it had space to finish the poem. And also, while I was swimming, the title came, and that is Milestones. My baby didn't cry when it was born. It breathed and blinked. There was so much world to look at. My baby didn't sleep. I put the cot by the window, and while I snored in the dark, it became acquainted with the constellations, night flight pilots, and astronauts on the International Space Station. My baby didn't speak. I gave it notebooks and sketch pads, which it filled with symbols I couldn't understand. My baby didn't walk. It crawled everywhere, then built carts of Lego powered with elastic bands when it was tired. My baby didn't smile, except at me. My baby didn't go out, even into the garden. I brought everything it needed and many of the things it wanted into the house. My baby didn't leave me. I loved it enough to let it go, but my baby loved me too much to even consider separation. My baby didn't die. And I'm going to finish with the poem that Peter published on proletarian poetry, Another Life. If Martin Luther King had been a postman, he would still have had a dream, but instead of sharing it with all the world at once, he would have told people individually, household by household, as he walked his walk, delivering letters and ideas. And they would have spread his words, neighbour to neighbour, over garden gates and hedges and cups of tea. And he would still have made a difference. Thank you. Thank you. It's now my pleasure to introduce Rishi Dastidar. Rishi has many qualifications and fantastic things about him. And one of them is he became an associate editor of the Rialto. And, I mean, his editing skills were good before then, but they've really sharpened him up. So he's now our kind of chief facilitator of the feedback sessions. And we really appreciate his sharp editor's eye. We were delighted to have a party earlier this year to celebrate the launch of his book Ticker Tape, published by Nine Arches. Jane Kermaine's in the room, and this is for sale out in the foyer afterwards, and Rishi will sign copies for you. He will explain, he doesn't know what his piece of music is yet, but he will know it when he hears it and will explain it to you when he comes up. Greg, Rishi's music, please.
Thank you, Jill. Good evening, Ledbury. The explanation is that at the front of the book is a flowchart. I can't quite remember what the thinking was as to why we had a flowchart poem in there. Jane is laughing, as if I could provide an explanation. I should be able to, but I can't. Now, it seemed a good idea at the time. It still is a good idea. But towards the end of said flowchart is a mention of Al Green's Take Me to the River, which that just was, which is one of my favourite songs. All of that provides absolutely no segue whatsoever into my first poem, which features the very expensive Californian magazine called Kinfolk, in which, for a large price, you too can achieve a wonderful lifestyle. The poem is called A Shark Comes to Dinner. Well, it's not a shark as such. More the nebbish simile Woody Allen used in Annie Hall. The one about how Marshall McLuhan has to keep moving forward to massage the message. Anyway, the dorsal fin is frantically stirring the pot, fretting that the lobsters, squash and carrots haven't been chopped finely enough according to the proto-hipster aesthetic, because, would you credit it, him with the teeth is afraid to bleed. Potluck kinfolk style, she'd said. And he'd flapped a happy yes, not knowing what two out of those three words meant. But hey, what did it matter? He'd seen enough master chefs to know you just had to do a journey, a chocolate fondant, and some alpine microherbs, then your life changed. Imagine the shock when he discovered that an induction hob could be as dangerous as a pedestal. And she wasn't going to undo her apron for any old Geordie come lately, brandishing Elizabeth David's come hither Mediterranean words. Calm, she commanded, as she swept him onto the table and bade him wait upon her homemade pastrami. He looked over and tried to drawl attractively. You've never seen a mammal wish so fervently to tell Linnaeus to stuff himself, become a slice of rye bread, gherkins, English mustard on the side. I have a pet theory that every British poet must have a poem that mentions the shipping forecast or they get kicked out of the union. This is mine. It's called The British Genius. The British genius isn't for financing things or inventing games, teaching them to others, playing them fairly, then badly, and still turning up. No, it's actually me, all the conversation, the hot air, if you like, that powers everything, anything of worth, note, not of value, that we do. All those lawyers, advertisers, politicos, pundits, journos, stuttering aristos, dare I say it, poets too. What do you think they run on? The charm, the listless seduction, where do you think they come from? You know why the shipping forecast is the nation's secular hymn? It's not for sailors. It's for those in the navy of hyperbole, so they know where to find me, to refill their sails. I spend Mondays to Thursdays working in an advertising agency. Don't blame me, the mortgage is big. And so this next poem speaks to that. Its presiding spirit is David Ogilvy, founder of the eponymous ad agency, which still bears his name and is now in a lovely building in London's Sea Containers House, just by the river. And he was one of the inspirations for the Mad Men series, which I'm sure some of you have watched, an expat Scotsman who had a very finely tuned sense of selling, indeed. And so, yes, he is the presiding spirit here. There is also mention made of the Frankfurt School, which I am sure you are all academic enough to know, is that movement, collection of German thinkers whose radical critiques have done so much to stop the rise of capitalism. This is called Making a Cheese Soufflé Rise. David Ogilvy is swashbuckling opposite me, wreathed in the blue smoke of his success. His expression says, do not think that advertising is not a job for you, that you are too proud to sell. I burnt my hands in kitchens in Paris, France, and sir, I can tell you these acts of persuasion you undertake are nothing compared to making a cheese souffle rise under the gaze of an elite brigade you can never join. And once you are done examining your navel, remember that this is a noble calling, alerting the world, waking it up, a poster campaign for life. You are the messenger of a good thing, whatever your Frankfurt School says, a thing called progress, a worthy thing for any man who calls himself a man. Now then, go, rise, work. And then it so happens, or it sometimes happens, more often than not, that said work means that I have to disappear to strange places for strange amounts of time to then present ads to people. And so I recently came back from New York, where I literally was there for 72 hours to scribble on flip chart sheets. I know, it's unbelievable, people pay me to do this. Who knows? This next poem talks to another one of those slightly crazy trips where I literally had to go to Norway for 24 hours to give a presentation on a subject which I knew nothing about 4 hours before being told I was going. And I somehow managed to busk it. But then this poem came out of that experience. It's called From Stavanger. I have been up for 23 hours now, teetering on the edge of missing home, missing her. And it's all I can do to resist the entreaties for one more slice of Norwegian salmon. Sound the retreat to the empty seat in the one desk terminal as I wait for the propellers of my ride to cut through the lassitude of clouds and get me rolling down the coast over triumphant Hanseatic business deals. But there is no such thing as a straight line above this earth. So we prowl above Amsterdam, a commuter eagle at Weary Bay, until the crook finger of the jet bridge beckons, and I run, slide, glide, perspire, curse, cry, drag, squeak, careen to the beacon-jacketed help, who with a smile of relaxed molasses says, "Sir, there's another connection in 45 minutes. Why not let Schiphol be your home for now? We have a beautiful sunset here too." I have a very, well, not strange, but it's somewhat unexpected that I have a passion for American football. It is long-standing. I am of that generation that grew up watching it when it was first broadcast on Channel 4 back in the 80s, and it's been recently revived. I tell you all this because this next poem is of that world and features that world. And there is mention made of yellow penalty flags. And so basically in the game, you've got a crew of umpires, referees, who are dressed as zebras. No, really, they are. And to indicate when a foul has been committed, they pull out a yellow flag from the back of their trouser pockets and throw it onto the floor. And it seems to work, apparently. The poem is called Red Zone. The stadium clocks are sprinting down. 1 second to go until the last timeout becomes permanent. I've been game managing with oblique slights and feints, but now in the red zone, I am fast revealed to be a rookie, a specialist in small plays. An eye flips up, a headset mic drops. Before the lashes, I am about to be coached. The stars aren't yellow penalty flags to avoid. Don't be scared by this aperture to explode into. To love is to play, is to risk, is to win. I will scoop up your forced fumble, but I cannot wait if you want me only after the fireworks of your current halftime show. As you might have gathered, some of these poems bear less than a passing resemblance to the truth. This next one is probably as close as I get to a true story. It's called Towards a Singularity. Talking about the end of time, the gap was filled by two physicists. It will never happen. Bent out of shape by the words, my whiskey rapier had no response. Her weapon was heartfelt logic. Clutching a white handbag shield, wearing a leopard print armour coat, she arrived in the King's Arms outside of our normal hours. The appointment was 5 p.m. The appointment was 5 p.m. outside of our normal hours. She arrived in the King's Arms wearing a leopard print armour coat, clutching a white handbag shield. Her weapon was heartfelt logic. My whiskey rapier had no response. Bent out of shape by the words, it will never happen. The gap was filled by two physicists talking about the end of time. Emma Hamilton. You all know Emma Hamilton. Yes? No? Yes. Nation's mistress. Nelson's mistress. then wife. You might not know George Romney, the 18th century's greatest portrait painter, and anyone who says Joshua Reynolds is can see me afterwards, and I shall tell them why they are wrong. Romney and Hamilton had a traditional muse painter relationship, and if you ever get a chance to see some of Romney's work with her in them, they're absolutely incredible, stunning stuff. So they're in this. It's called Licking Stamps. Let me guess, painter boy. You'll depict me as your Emma Hamilton in that Romney portrait, or Cheesecloth and Circe. Before moving on to some nonsense about how I'm an antebellum babe and that you have a battle plan for courting to neuter my Gatling gun tongue. And then you'll have me say something like, I want to be ravaged like Dresden in 1945, when clearly I want to be ravaged like Northumbria in 865. But still, really, the martial metaphor? I don't want things like fireworks or starlight either. The oil spill is better, but then that's making sex with me topical when it should be newsworthy. I know, I've got it. How about fucking me is like licking stamps? Sticky, time-consuming, and capable of taking you to destinations exotic and mundane. Yes, I like that very much. I don't think I can top that, can I? So I shall, with my thanks for all of you for coming out tonight, I shall take my leave with this. Normally when I read this, I have to explain to the non-writers in the room why they shouldn't use this word to describe this particular object. But as you are mostly writers in the room, you will know why you shouldn't use this word to describe this particular object. So please do not ever do so again. The poem is called Gunmetal. The sky vibrates like Mussolini's mistress's dentures in a Waterford tumbler. The sky throbs precipitately pink like the ululating estrogen of a Take That fan. The sky is a precious, precious green, Edmund, a precious, precious green. The sky is as cold as an ersatz gazpacho made out of a homeopathic Aldi tomato. The sky is as playfully obtuse as an obscure collection of Flaming Lips B-sides. The sky is as rigorously gloomy as a Bank of England economic prognostication. The sky is an edition of Noel's House Party, full of gunge and the sound of a booming god laughing at our pratfalls. The sky is a flying change of leg in the dressage. The sky is a Taoglin Google chat endlessly referring to its own digital circularity. The sky is not the sky, it is the sea, having got terribly confused at Job Centre Plus. The sky is an engine powered by steam and onions and polystyrene chips. The sky is just fucking awesome, okay, and doesn't need a weapons-based simile to make it so. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, that's my favourite of Rishi's poems. Thank you. Rishi's let me down a bit tonight, actually. You can tell he's a marketing man. He had a watch made with the logo from his book on it. That's quite impressive. So we've almost come to the end. We just have our leader, our founder, to finish off. And I want you to leave the theatre tonight with her poems ringing in your ears. So nobody's going to say anything after that. So I'm going to do the thank yous and the plugs now. And I think Katerina has something to say, something to do.
I've mainly got something to do, which is, hand these Ledbury balls to you, the infamous Ledbury balls.
Oh, so, wow.
Thank you very much for your readings, presentation.
And also, no, I, yeah, definitely. I've already got one in my room. You're only allowed one, however many times you're up here. And don't let me forget to get a team photo taken as well. So I would like to thank Ledbury Festival and the theatre staff, the stewards, and Greg
up in the box playing the music and doing the lights. Fantastic. I'd like to thank all of you for coming. As I mentioned earlier, tomorrow afternoon, back here in the theatre at 2:30, I'm presenting an event called Stablemates, which is a series that I run in London, and it has its name because each one features three poets from one publisher. And I suggested to Chloe that she might like to take one of these sessions, and we could liaise over which publisher and poets you might choose. And without hesitation, she said, People Tree. And I went, yes. So Seni Senavaratne, Roger Robinson, the other founder, and Nick McCoah, also one of the early members of Kitchen, they'll be here with me tomorrow afternoon. And because we're a collective, I mean, it's so fantastic that Chloe also said that we could come here and do a reading. But, you know, we do like to be interactive, so I thought it'd be nice for you guys to come and interact with us. So we're going to have a free coffee morning tomorrow morning at the Muse Cafe in Homen Muse, just near Specsavers. And you can come and bring a poem by yourself or by somebody else to read, or you can just come and listen. And we're going to take turns reading poems. And that's on the theme Fantastic Beast. So that's 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. And we're having it at the cafe so we can eat cake and drink coffee at the same time. Marvellous. So I think those are the parish notices. And so now it just remains to introduce Malaika. And I could talk to you about her writing achievements, but you can look them up. And you're going to hear some of her work just now anyway, much of which will come from her book Pepper Seed, which is on sale in the foyer. You have seen some of the influence that she has. You know, the five of us who've already read here. And she's one of the most generous people in poetry. She's always mentoring people. And just informally, I mean, even tonight, we had a bit of a rehearsal, and she said to one of our number, oh, let's sit down and just work out, you know, where you should put the pauses in that poem to let it come across to the audience better. There was a big event in London last week run by Peter Kahn, who was one of the original members of Malaika's Kitchen. He's from Chicago, and when he went back to Chicago, he set up a kitchen over there as well. And he honoured Kitchen and Malaika in because we've been running for 16 years, he had a Sweet 16 party for us at this event. And Malaika and Roger were both invited on stage to talk about how Kitchen started, and they both spoke really movingly, and some of it was about how they weren't really accepted as serious poets when they started, and some of it might have been about their race or the fact they were immigrants, or simply that they came from a spoken word background and perhaps the page poetry elite didn't really accept them. But last year Malaika was chair of the judges of the Forward Prizes, and you don't get much more establishment than that. And other members of Kitchen have been nominated for the Forward Prizes. Karen McCarthy-Wolf was nominated a couple of years ago. Nick, who's reading tomorrow, his debut collection has been nominated. And Malaika herself has been nominated at last for Best Single Poem for Nine Nights, which she's going to read to you this evening. You're going to know why I've chosen this music for her. Please welcome Malaika Booker.
Malaika, nakupenda Malaika. Malaika.
Oh my God. I love that song. Good afternoon or good evening, everybody. Or rather, good night. I don't know what time of day it is anymore. Okay. I get really embarrassed when people start talking about Kitchen, and it's really good when everyone comes up and says I'm a member of Kitchen, but when people start talking about me with it, I get really embarrassed. But I'm going to change and become me. There were some fantastic poems earlier on. How great were they? So I'm going to start off by reading Nine Nights, which has been, which is the poem that was shortlisted for the foreword. And I have to say, in the interest of community, I read this poem at an event that Nick McCullough had put on last year in King's University. And Kai Miller was there, and Kyle Chingoni. And Kai Miller turned around and said, which he, you know, he's really a man of compliment. He said, "It's a good poem." And then Kyle Chingoni was a guest editor at the poetry review, and he phoned me and said, "Malaika, can you send me that poem, that Lazarus poem?" And I said, "It's not finished. I can't get it on the page right." And he said, "Please, just send it to me." So I sent it to him, and he helped me to edit it. So this poem wouldn't have been anywhere because I was just like, it's not ready to be sent out yet. So thank you, Kayo. A few things happened. One, my friend Roger Robinson was reading through Pepperseed again, and he said, "You're a very funny person in real life, and like, your poems are just deadly serious and just raw and emotional and gutting." Two, I was working on a collection where I wondered what would happen if you changed the language and the geography of the Bible to the Caribbean. What would that do to the poems? And I got a job at Leeds University as Douglas Castor Fellow. And there, that was to interview members of the Caribbean community about funerals and to write poems. So I thought to myself, I'm going to do the Bible poems on Monday and Tuesday, and then on Wednesday and Thursday and Friday, I'm going to work on funerals. And then Nine Nights happened, and I realized that I had to just put down the Bible project and just work on funerals. So in the Caribbean, or Caribbean funerals, are a really big affair. They're really boisterous. Most of them turn into a party at the end with a feast. And I just wondered, I mean, so much investment in the funeral, because people usually say it was a good send-off, and so came, and this happened. And gradually, by the end of it, you don't really speak about the person. So I started wondering what would happen if in the middle of all of that, and some Caribbean islands celebrate something called Nine Nights, the wake, nine-night wake. What would happen if Lazarus came back in the middle of the wake? So this poem is about that. Nine Nights, the setup. If you did see people that first night, people for soul, who come from town, from far like St. David, from near like St. Mark, to this little St. John's parish, it had the makings of a good funeral. Pure bus park up by Guav roadside like ants. Their mourners arrive shuffling with the shock. The priest open up that wake with plenty prayers. Corn soup bubbled in the iron pot. Red beans slowly converge with rice, thyme, and coconut milk. Chairs clustered like fowl in the yard. Tilly mother fell down under the weight of her dead son. "So young," she muttered, "so young." Song. Grief song is a different story. It's a clap of hands, then a rocking back of forward story. Grief song is a body dance into a jagged melody story. Grief song is so searing, it's the belly drops to knees story. Grief song is the way his mother sinks into the arms of Rock of Ages story. I tell you, grief song is a hard to tell story. So someone at the funeral inevitably talks about the dreams where they foresaw something, and everybody understands what those dreams are. So Lazarus in the Bible has two sisters, Martha and Mary. The dreams. Martha had dreams for so since the night he died. And wise woman Clarice could not make head nor tail of flying fish and hummingbirds over rough river water, of Edo swimming on the rocky soil, of septic tank full of bleach and blue soap. "What does it mean?" she muttered. "What does it mean?" Funeral announcement. So most of the diaspora and most people in the Caribbean, they usually hear about death through the funeral announcements that come over the internet or on private radio or on the radio station. To hear his name called dry so on radio was the son of, brother of, left behind, brought her up, and them dotish dogs howling a relentless dirge for their master, who never pelt them with kick, who boil one fresh pot of dog food, chicken neck with gravy and white rice every morning like greeting. Them dogs howl, so till grief lock off the windpipe. His resurrection. Well, when Lazarus fast up and step cross the threshold of your own wake, rank with corpse stink, the wake broke up. Who put foot out of the door quick time? Miss Gibbs, forget she hips bad, till she take two steps and fall brat up. Mr. Power start moan about the good money he dash away on pretty funeral frock for Betty, and now she can't even use it. And Uncle Johnny start fling rum, shouting, "You're dead, man! You're dead!" Like libation have any power over the resurrected. Vexation. So the wakes, you always get, there's certain nights where you get older Caribbean women, and they're very righteous and very religious and very sanctimonious, and they sing, they come to sing the hymns and do all the prayers. Vexation. It had the makings of a boss funeral, mourners mourned, sulking into wake shadow. Martyr strups, or strups is like a kisti, which is just vexation, which is, which Caribbean people do. Martyr strups over and over like chant. Her venomous kiss teeth, terrifying even tough back crapple. And Mary vexed too bad. How we could go and make their serious work of grief into a pappy show. Mary head get hot. Look how much white candle mother burn to light he way, and how like stubborn jackass he refused to follow instructions. Just turn away from the light bold face so. This was just like when he was hard as to leave he mother womb. And the old choir women in the back room just singing and stop singing and only cussing bad word, while at the shame and slander of this thing. Fling down party. So in the wakes, there's always a party at the end. And I just thought, well, Lazarus decided to come back and have his own party. Lazarus dash away hymns and cuss words from his house with the heavy bass of a thumping speaker box. The floorboards start tremble as his foot rise up and skip, as his fingers lick and clap when the Rastaman chant take over, give thanks. Lazarus dance fire and brimstone, dance chant down Babylon, start lick fist on fragile board wall, start shout more fire, as if alive scatter springs into his steps, as if alive shake up his mind. He locks swinging like thick twine, tied to air, and he chanting, I and I liberty. I and I liberty. Geography of resurrection. So I thought, you know, now he's like a little superstar. The reporter who's going to be a woman is going to come up and he's going to use this as a chat-up line. And when the reporter woman asked Lazarus what it was like as they sat in the cream wall room with the hum of mosquitoes, and he said, there's a chart to being resurrected, an atlas that have enough mud swamp, sweet river water and thorny parts. There's a one foot in front of the other chart. I believe and it shall be chart. A surrender chart. A rhythm chant chart. And you just have to trot it, our rude girl. You just have to trot it. The laying of hands. And when they saw he still lived his ninth day, they cancelled Lacroix Funeral Parlor. Grabby up in a white sheet, tote him, swinging like he in a rocking hammock to the seashore, and rolled him in the coarse hot sand, then dunk his head in the salty sea, washing death's stench off of him, and then they anointed him, all palms seeking to touch their feeble miracle. Thank you. Right. Such a long poem. Yeah, I think tonight I thought I'd do some poems that I don't do, actually. I thought I'd do one poem that I don't do. So, Brother Wakening. Early morning. There are men who dash ripe fruit on hard stone again and again, grind heels on ladies' hearts, smile into their faces like angels, climb women's back stairs, polish shoes, breaking the threads of each stair, even when they tiptoe in. Each assault scares me, and I am their flesh and blood. Hearts ground into red dust of hot pepper to burn others who venture near. Yellow warning. Your mother and I feast with your cast-out women. After each tale, we tie yellow ribbons around our tears, weep, shame in our eyes, as if we hurt them. I want to paint yellow X's on your door to warn the next woman of her fate. Place you in quarantine, son of my father, son of my grandfather, son of my great-grandfather. Be judge and executioner. Mark you all yellow. String petal necklaces to choke your neck. Mother distributes amber to prospective girlfriends to inform their decision-making. Red warning. It's too late. We meet them already reeled in. Slicing has begun. Delicate nips. How do you warn fish they're in danger when they're already bleeding? Aware we're the red herrings in the introductions. And this is my favorite poem. I never thought that when you wrote poetry, you'd have your own favorite poem of your poem. But this is it. For several reasons. One, if I could sing, I wouldn't be a poet. I'm going to tell you now. I'd be some R&B singer, I'm telling you. But I can't sing. I'm terrible. And I like this poem because it soars. And I'm proud of it because I think it achieves what I wanted it to do. In moments of great loss, we use song and we sing to heal, to enable. And this poem does this. This poem is a tribute to my aunt who brought me up in England, who passed away. Faith. Oh, sorry. And also, I wrote this. I was in Slovenia, and they took me to this museum. And it's one of those. Have you ever gone to those museum places that's like a house, and it looks like people might have lived there and just walked out? Faith. The museum is an own house, a dead lifestyle. In the living room, pictures of Jesus forlorn, an old rosary hanging over the bed. This how we lived in old days, they tell me. I understand old ones die, like you did, Auntie, the way your soul left your body blank on bleached sheets, the way these people left their home. I look at this old bed now. Did a mother die here, choking on her spit too? Is this her rosary? Did she lose it all? I visit the hospital a month before you die. Your left big toe is a blackening cherry. Cut it, we beg, but our pleas are mute. You are Taurus, stoic, resolute. And that day you lost your rosary for 2 days. We searched on the beds and in fruit bowls. You cried nonstop all night. Nurses sift mountains of soiled sheets until the rosary is found, nestled in your dirty pillowcase. And when they give it to you, your fingers continue to roll as if it had not strayed. And then you, who clutch your faith like a second skin, whisper to me, I have lost faith in my Lord. 2. And I want to write a hymn for you, where voices lift and sudden black choirs rock. I want to write a hymn for you where sinners ride weeping bitter tears. I want to write a hymn for you where Baptist priests fling words at the congregation like fire and Catholic priests draw holy water into the sky. I want to write a classic hymn, all harps and harmonicas. A hymn where our slave grandmas, that's my time, where slave grandmas lift up their long frocks and trample the earth to tambourines. I want to write calypso hymns, folk hymns, reggae hymns, joyous hymns. I want to write sweet, sweet hymns just for you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Give a big round of applause to Jill for organising this. Thank you, and Ledbury.